Welcome back to The Deep Dive. Our mission here is to take the sources you share with us, filter out all the noise, and really just deliver the critical insights you need to be well-informed and fast.
And today, we're cracking open a concept that I think everyone feels like they know, the scientific method.
Right.
It's that rigid five-step recipe most of us were handed in school. You know, observation, hypothesis, experiment, conclusion.
The flowchart.
Exactly, the flowchart. It's always presented as this very clean, very sequential path for how science is supposed to work.
And if you stop there, you miss.
Yeah.
Well, you miss everything. The sources you send over make it really clear that the reality is just so much messier.
Oh, absolutely.
It's highly iterative.
Yeah.
And it fundamentally relies on, you know, actual human intelligence, imagination, and a massive dose of creativity. It's not just a strict, unthinking recipe.
Right. And so this deep dive is really your shortcut to understanding those philosophical foundations and all the varied, sometimes contradictory methods that really make up scientific inquiry today.
So let's start with the core identity. What is it at its heart?
Well, since about the 17th century, the core idea has been that it's an empirical process for acquiring knowledge. It all comes down to rigorous skepticism, extremely careful observation, and then systematically testing ideas.
And of course, validation through evidence.
Exactly. But what I think makes this method so potent is its radical self-awareness. It starts from the assumption that our own cognitive biases,
the things that make us human.
Right. Those things can and often do distort how we interpret what we see. So the method is, in a lot of ways, a system built to fight our own minds.
In a system like that, a self-correcting one, it must have taken millennia to develop.
It did. We often think of this as a purely modern thing, but the sources show us that the roots of this kind of rigor, they stretch back incredibly far. You can trace lines of thought to the ancient Greek Stoics.
With their emphasis on logic and methodical observation.
And Aristotle, of course. His work really laid the groundwork for systematic classification.
But there's a piece of historical context that often gets glossed over, and that's the critical role of the Islamic Golden Age. We're talking about thinkers like the 11th century polymath Al-Hazen.
Yes, he's often called the father of optics, and for good reason.
What was his big contribution?
Well, Al-Hazen didn't just observe. He established the vital importance of testing theories experimentally. He really formalized this process of combining observation with controlled experiments, which was a huge leap beyond the pure thought experiments that some of the earlier Greek scholars favored.
And he wasn't alone.
Not at all. You have someone like Avicenna in his Canon of Medicine, who detailed these really rigorous requirements for how to conduct medical trials. He was emphasizing the need for controlled conditions, for ruling out bias. I mean, these are fundamental shifts toward modern empiricism.
So the practice of scientific inquiry is ancient, but the actual term, the scientific method, that only came to popular use in the 19th century. Why? Why the big delay?
That delay lines up almost perfectly with the institutional development of science itself. As fields started to professionalize and researchers began specializing, there was a real need to, you know, define the boundaries.
To build a fence around what science was.
Precisely.
Right.
The method became a shared standard, a gatekeeper, really. It was used to define what a scientist was, and maybe more critically, to separate legitimate inquiry from what was then getting labeled as pseudoscience.
Okay, so let's unpack this iterative cycle. Let's move from that simple textbook ideal to the working reality. The textbook version is rigid, but the operational schema scientists actually use is... it's a lot more dynamic. It's often generalized into about 8 steps.
And we should really emphasize that this is a guideline, right? It's not a sequential list you have to check off.
Not at all.
It's more of a pragmatic map. You start by, 1, defining a question or identifying a problem. Then 2, you gather existing info, you do some initial observations. 3, you form your hypothesis.
Your best guess.
Your best reasoned guess. Then step 4 is testing that hypothesis, usually with an experiment, and collecting data. 5 is analyzing that data. 6 is interpreting it, drawing conclusions, and this is key.
Mm.
That often leads to refining your idea or even forming a completely new hypothesis.
And then 7 is publishing your work.
And then step 8, which is maybe the most important part for scientific rigor, is retesting, the replication of the results by other people.
What's really essential for you to get here is that the cycle doesn't just go in a straight line. It loops back on itself all the time.
Right. It's not just from conclusion back to a new hypothesis. Sometimes you get new data and you have to go all the way back to redefining the original question. Or maybe you realize you need to gather more foundational information. It's not a line, it's a spiral of refinement.
So those 8 steps are the big picture.
Mm-hmm.
But if we distill the whole process down, philosophers of science tend to agree on four core components that have to be there for any inquiry to be, you know, meaningful scientific.
The first component is characterizations. This is all about meticulous observation, developing really clear definitions and careful measurements of whatever it is you're studying.
And this stage is just so vital because the entire framework, everything else you do, it rests on the accuracy of what you're measuring in the first place.
That's a great point. The sources highlight that the quality of this stage is often what separates true science from more speculative fields. I mean, think about what separated alchemy from chemistry.
It was the systematic collection of measurements.
Exactly, that rigorous, organized approach. And it's crucial that scientific definitions are precise. We have to distinguish between, say, common usage and a technical definition, like the example of mass versus weight.
In everyday conversation, they're the same thing.
Right, interchangeable. But in mechanics, mass is an intrinsic property of an object, while weight is the force exerted on it by gravity. That precision is everything. And it often requires specialized instruments, whether it's a simple tool or a massive device like a particle accelerator.
Okay, so that's component one. The second is hypotheses. These are the suggested explanations, the reasoned proposals. And they often take the form of these predictive mathematical models.
And the single most discussed feature of a hypothesis, thanks to the philosopher Karl Popper, is its falsifiability.
The ultimate filter.
It really is. Falsifiability just means that there has to be a conceivable experiment or an observation that could potentially prove your hypothesis wrong. It has to conflict with the predictions.
So if a hypothesis is so vague or so flexible that it can explain every possible outcome after the fact,
then it's not testable. And in a rigorous sense, it's unscientific.
So a theory that says the stock market will go either up or down tomorrow is useless. It risks nothing. A real scientific hypothesis has to take the risk of being proven wrong.
Precisely. And this leads right into the third component, predictions. These are the logical consequences that you derive from your hypothesis, usually through deductive reasoning.
And there's a critical rule here, novelty.
Yes. The outcome of testing this prediction must be currently unknown for a successful result to actually increase your confidence in the hypothesis.
Why is that so important?
Because if we already know the result, it was probably factored into how you formed the hypothesis in the first place. So all you're doing is demonstrating internal consistency, not actual predictive power.
Okay, and that brings us to the fourth component, experiments. The actual systematic test designed to seek out those novel predictions. This is where you really have to deal with observational error.
This is where a concept you brought up earlier, Mills canons, becomes so important. These are fundamental methods for inductive inference from the philosopher John Stuart Mill.
So when we talk about experimental control, yeah, we're often talking about applying these ideas.
Specifically, the method of difference, which basically means that if you have two situations that are identical in every single way, except for one variable.
That's one.
Just one. And a phenomenon occurs in a situation where that variable is present but doesn't occur where it's absent, then that single variable is the cause, or at least a necessary part of the cause.
So experimental control is all about isolating variables.
It is. It's about providing a contrast between multiple samples under different but controlled conditions. That isolation is how we fight observational error and demonstrate genuine correlation or, ideally, causation.
That breakdown of the four components really helps you appreciate how complex this iterative engine truly is. And to see it in action, let's look at the discovery of the structure of DNA. It perfectly illustrates this messy spiraling cycle.
The starting point, the initial characterization, was really set by the mid-20th century. Gregor Mendel's work had established the laws of inheritance, and by 1944, Oswald Avery had shown that DNA carried the genetic information. The central unsolved problem was how. How is this incredibly complex information physically stored and then replicated?
And this uncertainty created space for several hypotheses. The famous chemist Linus Pauling, based on his own data, proposed a triple helix structure for DNA.
It was a highly plausible hypothesis, but it was also wrong. And what's interesting is that Francis Crick and James Watson were able to discard Pauling's structure almost immediately, based on existing knowledge. They knew DNA was an acid, which meant its phosphate groups should be ionized, negatively charged.
And in Pauling's structure,
he put those groups close together at the core of the helix, which would have meant they had to be unionized. A molecule with that many negative charges packed so tightly would immediately repel itself and just fly apart.
So an error in one crucial piece of characterization data Let them eliminate a leading hypothesis right off the bat. The process works because you're constantly cross-referencing against what's already known.
Exactly. So the next major phase involved a critical piece of observation and prediction, and this was driven by Rosalind Franklin's work. When Watson saw photo 51, her famous X-ray diffraction image, it was an instant breakthrough.
Why was that X shape so important? What did it show?
Because that specific X-shaped pattern was the prediction implied by something called the Cochrane-Crickvan-Stokes theorem. It's a mathematical description that says diffraction from any helical structure produces that exact X-shaped pattern.
So it didn't solve the structure?
No, but it confirmed a major structural constraint. It had to be a helix.
This is where the ingenuity and the iteration really kicks in. They realized that trying to solve this with more, you know, highly theoretical math was going to be way too slow.
So they shifted their approach. They started building physical models based on empirical constraints.
And this meant using previously characterized data, right? Like Chargaff's rules.
Right. Erwin Chargaff had shown that the amounts of adenine, or A, and thymine, T, were always equal. Same for guanine, G, and cytosine, C. But even with those rules, their first models just wouldn't fit together.
The breakthrough came from correcting another piece of characterization data. Their colleague, Jerry Donahue, he told them the standard textbook diagrams of the base pairs were actually wrong.
They were using what's called the enol form, but the molecules actually exist in the keto form. The difference is subtle. It's just about where the atoms are placed, but it's fundamental. It changes where the hydrogen bonds can form.
And when Watson and Crick used that corrected keto form in their physical models,
everything clicked. They realized that an adenine-thymine pair held by two hydrogen bonds was identical in shape and size to a guanine-cytosine pair held by three.
And that physical fit was the final piece of the puzzle. The elegant, self-consistent double helix structure. They went from defining a problem to refuting a bad hypothesis to confirming a prediction from physics and then iterating rapidly with physical models guided by corrected data.
And their final paper, which was only about 900 words, it concluded with the ultimate scientific prediction. They wrote, "It has not escaped our notice that the specific pairing we have postulated immediately suggests a possible copying mechanism for the genetic material."
Wow.
The structure itself screamed function. And that kicked off the next massive cycle of inquiry in biology.
The DNA story really showcases the process, but what keeps that process, you know, honest,
yeah,
and reliable? Our sources stress these foundational principles, striving for accuracy, honesty, openness, and above all, rigorous skepticism.
And at the heart of that skepticism is falsifiability. We mentioned Karl Popper and his insistence on this as the sharp line of demarcation between what is science and what is not.
Let's dig into that a little deeper. How does Popper's idea help you differentiate between a truly scientific theory and one that's just comprehensive?
Okay, think about psychoanalysis versus general relativity in Popper's framework. According to Popper, psychoanalytic theories were constructed in a way that they could explain any human behavior.
Right. No matter what a person did, the theory could explain it after the fact.
Exactly. It's a retroactive explanation machine. If a theory explains everything, it predicts nothing specific, and so it can never be refuted.
Contrast that with Einstein.
Einstein's theory of general relativity made a very specific, very high-risk prediction that light from distant stars would be deflected by a measurable amount when passing close to the sun. If the 1919 solar eclipse observation had shown no deflection,
the theory would have been falsified.
It would have been proven false. It took the risk of being wrong. And that, for Popper, is what made it truly scientific. The value of a theory is its willingness to expose itself to being refuted.
But science also has to deal with this built-in human limitation, the observation paradox or theory latentness.
This is a huge concept for you to get. The limitation is simple. There is no such thing as pure, uninterpreted observation. Any data we gather requires a prior theoretical framework, a set of concepts, just to be understood.
So what you observe is inherently influenced by what you already believe.
That's it. The classic example is the rivalry between the astronomers Tycho Brahe and Johannes Kepler. They were looking at the exact same sky, the same celestial bodies, but they drew radically different conclusions.
Because their prior theories were different.
Completely different. They both observed the sunrise. Brahe was working with a geocentric model. He thought the Earth was the center. And because of that, he missed certain optical facts. He actually concluded it would be impossible to ever see the solar corona during an eclipse.
But Kepler, working with a sun-centered model, he interpreted the same visual data differently.
Right. Kepler was already thinking about optics and geometry, and he correctly deduced that the size of the viewing aperture controlled the sharpness of the image, a basic fact of optics now. Brahe missed that because his conceptual framework wasn't even looking for that kind of problem.
So this complexity means our tools for reasoning, for scientific rationality, they have to be robust enough to handle data that might be biased by our own theories. Which brings us to induction and deduction.
Right, the two primary justifications for truth. Inductive reasoning is building general principles from lots of specific observations. If you see 1,000 swans and they're all white, you induce the general principle all swans are white.
The conclusion is probable, but it's never guaranteed. All it takes is one black swan to disprove it. So induction is really used to generate hypotheses, to spot patterns.
Exactly. And conversely, deductive reasoning works by deriving specific conclusions from established general principles. If premise one is all men are mortal and premise two is Socrates is a man, then the conclusion Socrates is mortal must be true.
As long as the premises are true.
Right. And deduction is used to test hypotheses by figuring out their specific logical consequences.
The history of gravity is a perfect illustration of how these two work together. You have thousands of years of astronomical data collected by, the Chaldeans, the Indians, the Greeks. That was just massive scale inductive data collection, pure observation.
And that inductively gathered data is what allowed Kepler to formulate his three laws of planetary motion. They were general principles based on empirical patterns.
And then a few decades later, Isaac Newton used deductive reasoning to unify all of it. He used his general principles of motion and gravity to deduce the specific motions that Kepler had observed.
But the cycle doesn't stop. In the 19th century, astronomers noticed that Mercury's orbit didn't quite match Newton's deduction. That observation, that counterexample, proved Newton's theory was incomplete.
And that pushed Einstein toward his general relativity calculations, which matched the observation much more closely.
And that's the messy spiral in action. A failure in deduction forces new observation, which leads to a new wave of induction, which generates a more robust theory.
Speaking of human flaws, scientific methodology has to constantly fight personal bias, especially confirmation bias, our tendency to see what we expect to see.
It's a huge risk, especially when observation is so theory-laden. We're wired to favor evidence that confirms what we already believe. That's why the methodology demands testing under highly controlled conditions to try and diminish those effects.
There's a wonderful visual anecdote for this, the historical belief in the flying gallop.
Oh, I love this one.
For centuries, artists depicted galloping horses with all four legs splayed out in midair, because that's what the human eye thought it saw, is what people expected to see during the fastest part of the stride.
It was a powerful, centuries-long confirmation bias, reinforced by art. And it took a rigorous, dispassionate experiment. Specifically, Eadweard Muybridge's stop-action photography in 1878 to finally kill it.
His photos showed definitively that when a horse's legs are all off the ground, they're actually gathered up underneath its body, not splayed out.
The empirical fact, provided by a technological experiment, completely invalidated a powerful human assumption.
So we've established the method is iterative, it's flexible. Let's explore the actual variation scientists use, moving beyond that simple four-part cycle to look at specific frameworks for inquiry.
The most traditional framework, and one we've kind of touched on, is the hypothetico-deductive method, or HD method. It's hypothesis first. It relies on deductive reasoning to test that hypothesis. But crucially, it doesn't test the theory itself directly.
It tests the implications of the theory. Okay, what does that mean for how certain the conclusion is?
It means we're relying on a specific logical structure called modus tollens. If theory A implies implication B, and we find out that implication B is false.
Then theory A must also be false.
Right. It's valid deductive logic. The test refutes the theory, but the reverse logic doesn't work.
Meaning, if implication B is found to be true, it doesn't necessarily prove theory A is true.
Exactly. It only provides support or confirmation for theory A. It doesn't prove it because there might be some other theory C out there that also implies B. This is why Popper was so fixated on falsifiability. Successful tests can build confidence, but they never give you absolute certainty.
Okay, so moving away from that hypothesis-first approach, we have the inductive method, which has seen this huge resurgence lately with big data.
Right. This is a data-driven approach. It focuses on formulating a research question, collecting a massive amount of data, and then letting the knowledge arise inductively after you have the data. You let the patterns in the data speak for themselves.
What's the main advantage of going data-first like that?
It's praised for being theoretically neutral. By not starting with the specific hypothesis, you can diminish the risk of confirmation bias. You're allowing patterns to emerge that no one might have preconceived.
And third, we have mathematical modeling. This involves creating an abstract construct that you can test instead of a physical experiment. The sources call this alloctonous reasoning.
Alloctonous just means originating in a different place. So the reasoning originates in the mathematical construct, not the physical world. It uses simplification and abstraction to create a usable model.
So the math model becomes the lab, and then you need a way to translate the results from that lab back to reality.
Right, and those are the correspondence rules. They translate the mathematical results back to observable phenomena. The strength here is its power in really complex systems where a physical experiment might be impossible or just way too expensive.
Now, all of these different variations, HD, induction, modeling, they all lead to this core philosophical question that really shook things up in the mid-20th century. Is there even a scientific method?
This is the real aha moment for a lot of people, because the idea that there's one universal method was profoundly challenged. Thinkers like Thomas Kuhn started questioning whether science really progressed smoothly using a single unified method at all.
Right, his work on paradigm shifts. He suggested that science operates within these established frameworks or paradigms until a crisis forces a revolution.
Hmm.
And if the methodology changes between paradigms, how can there be one single method?
And this philosophical conflict really boiled down to two camps, unificationists and pluralists. Unificationists argued for a single useful definition of method that could apply across all the sciences.
But pluralists looked at the sheer variety of how science is actually done, all the different methods used in different labs, and they just rejected the idea that one universal definition could ever be useful. Science, they argued, is just too diverse in practice.
And out of this discourse came the most radical critique of all, from Paul Feyerabend. He called it epistemological anarchism.
Anything goes. That's his famous line from Against Method.
That was his joking suggestion for the only universally valid rule. He argued that if you look at the history of major breakthroughs, you'll find there are no universal, exception-free methodological rules. He claimed that scientific progress often relied on violating the established norms.
He basically said that insisting on one rigid method would only stifle creativity and innovation.
Exactly. Now, that sounds dangerous, right? We want innovation, but we can't just let scientists throw out all the rules.
So how do you balance that? The need for radical innovation with the need for reliable evidence.
That is the critical tension. And while Feyerabend really championed the role of violating norms, the consensus remains that skepticism and prudent management are still essential. But his great contribution was to permanently undermine the belief that the textbook recipe was an accurate picture of scientific reality.
So if we synthesize this whole debate, the singular sequential scientific method that's taught in high school is, well, it's widely seen by historians and philosophers of science as a myth, or at least an idealization.
It serves a purpose. It's a communication tool in education. It sets out ideals of rigor and honesty. But it just doesn't reflect the messy, local, and flexible way scientists actually work.
If the method is so fluid, how do scientists choose between competing hypotheses, especially when the evidence might be limited? This is where heuristics come in, these guiding principles, rather than hard and fast rules.
Heuristics are crucial for the human side of science. We need ways to decide which theoretical path is the most fruitful to pursue. Thomas Kuhn identified several, but we can focus on three really essential ones.
Starting with the classic, parsimony or Occam's razor.
Parsimony just recommends the simplest explanation when the data supports multiple ideas equally well. Isaac Newton put it very clearly. We should admit no more causes than are both true and sufficient to explain their appearances.
So if you have two theories explaining planetary motion, you choose the one with the fewest unsupported assumptions.
That's the idea. But it's not always about starting simple. The economist Paul Krugman once advised researchers to dare to be silly first, to broaden their theoretical view before trying to simplify. So you often start with a bunch of messy ideas and then use parsimony as a filter to select the most economical model.
Okay, next up we have elegance. That definitely sounds subjective.
It is, but it often describes a theory that has a kind of deep symmetry and simplicity, and it avoids being jammed with fudge factors.
Duck factors.
Those are the arbitrary corrections or parameters you add just to save a failing idea from being refuted. An elegant theory doesn't need them. But the danger is that relying too much on what feels aesthetically pleasing can prevent a breakthrough into a new, maybe uglier, but more accurate paradigm.
And finally, a concept that became really powerful after Einstein, invariance.
Invariance is the idea that good scientific structures are independent of your perspective. It gained a lot of weight because Einstein's theories reduced physics to these fundamental relationships that were unchangeable, regardless of the observer's motion or position. The physicist David Deutsch called these hard-to-vary explanations.
Can you give us a concrete example of that?
Sure. Think about the equivalence principle in general relativity. The idea that gravitational mass and inertial mass are the same thing. Einstein used a thought experiment of an observer in a windowless elevator in deep space.
Okay.
If the elevator is accelerated uniformly upward, the observer inside feels a force pressing them down, which is indistinguishable from gravity. The physical laws are invariant. That powerful invariant observation was a key argument for equating the two types of mass, something Newtonian mechanics couldn't explain.
We focus so much on rigorous methods, but we have to acknowledge the role of chance or serendipity in discovery.
Mm-hmm.
Science isn't always a linear pursuit.
Not at all. Some estimates suggest that between a third and a half of all scientific discoveries are stumbled upon, not sought out. Alexander Fleming's discovery of penicillin is the classic case. He left a bacteria culture plate uncovered, it got contaminated by mold, and he just happened to notice the bacteria died off around the mold. He wasn't looking for antibiotics.
Louis Pasteur famously said, serendipity favors the prepared mind. But what does that preparation actually look like?
Well, the psychologist Kevin Dunbar studied how scientists actually work, and he found that the discovery process often starts when researchers find bugs in their experiments, unexpected results that contradict what they thought would happen.
So most researchers would assume they just messed up the experiment.
Right. They try to fix their technique. But the prepared mind is the one that recognizes the error is too persistent, too specific to be a coincidence. The scientific method's emphasis on control and careful documentation actually helps researchers spot these systematic errors and realize they might be a new phenomenon.
That's interesting. The rigor actually makes the system more open to unexpected results.
Exactly. It makes it anti-fragile.
Now, speaking of rigor, we should address some modern limits, particularly the challenges posed by statistics.
This is a major contemporary crisis in science. John Ioannidis's 2005 paper, Why Most Published Research Findings Are False, was foundational for the whole field of metacidence. He showed that findings are less likely to be true when studies are small and when there's a lot of flexibility in how the study is designed and analyzed.
So what does that mean for you, the listener?
It means you have to apply critical scrutiny. When you read a headline about some small nutritional study that seems counterintuitive, remember Ioannidis's logic. If the initial probability of a finding being true is already low and the study is small, the reported results are likely false, or at least impossible to replicate.
And finally, how does this classic scientific method cope with genuinely complex systems and big data?
It's difficult. Applying the method stringently to interconnected systems like climate science or genomics is tough because you can't really isolate variables. And with big data, there's a risk that data might get stripped of its context, of the rich variables you need to formulate and test alternative hypotheses. If the data is only used to support one predetermined idea, it undermines the whole function of skepticism and falsification.
So our deep dive really confirms it. The linear recipe we learn in school is just an idealization. The true scientific method is a flexible, iterative, and critically self-correcting cycle.
Its strength isn't in following rigid rules, but in adhering to these core principles. Rigorous skepticism, the insistence on falsifiability, and that continuous messy balance between observation and theoretical reasoning.
It's a very human process. It thrives on intelligence, imagination, iteration, challenge, and even chance.
It's a process where confirmation by a collective of prepared minds is necessary for an idea to be accepted,
mm-hmm.
but where innovation is often sparked by someone violating the norms or just by sheer luck.
To leave you with a final provocative thought, the philosopher Imre Lakatos argued that in non-axiomatic math, no theorem is ever truly final. A mathematical conjecture is only considered true until a counterexample is found, forcing continuous revision through contradiction and refusal.
So think about that. If even the fundamental conjectures of mathematics, the very language physics and chemistry are written in, are subject to this constant state of revision, how should that unfinality impact how you view established scientific facts in your daily life? The strength of a theory isn't really measured in its certainty. It's measured in how long and how successfully it has persisted, facing down challenges and counterexamples without major changes to its core ideas. That enduring quality is the true power and the humility of science.